You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-fits-all branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear, all backed by above and beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code POD20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20. Code POD20 for 20% off your first product.
Talking history on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Egan. In tonight's show, mad dogs, jewels, and dynamite in 19th century Dublin, the visit of Douglas Hyde to the United States at the time of the San Francisco earthquake, the forgotten history of Hispanic North America, the most influential Victorian building in Dublin. And then to end the show, we'll discuss a new oral history of Galway's University. Last week, we looked at the life and legacy of Jenny Wise Power and how she has been ignored for too long in Irish history. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. But first, the Peeler's Notebook. Dublin during the 19th century could be an unforgiving city, especially for the unwary. Established in 1836, the Metropolitan Police patrolled its dark alleys and streets and fought running battles with violent tenement mobs, Fenian rebels, street gangs and self-proclaimed kings. And a new book, The Peeler's Notebook, Policing Victorian Dublin, Mad Dogs, Jewels and Dynamite, explores these dangers. It's published in hardback by Mercier Press and costs €14.99. The author is Barry Kennerick. And Barry, you're very welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Patrick.
Can we begin with, I suppose, the establishment of this new police force in 1836? What was it replacing and what did it intend to do?
Well, it replaced an old city watch, which had been in existence, I suppose, since medieval times. And the old watchmen were quite characteristic. They occupied boxes. They sat in the evening time. They might have a lighted brazier out front. They carried pike staffs. They carried a wooden rattle, which would be, I suppose, very reminiscent of the type of rattles that they'd use at football matches years ago, that would make a loud clacking sound to summon help in times of danger. But they were very ineffective. And what students from Trinity College used to do, in fact, was they liked to push the old watchman forward in his box, face down, so that he couldn't get out. And then the college rooms were full of all sorts of, prizes that the students had taken away, like the pike staffs, which they'd mount on the walls of the dorms and so on. So it was very ineffectual and needed to be replaced.
And Robert Peel was behind this new force.
That's right. He was the Undersecretary for Ireland at that time. He had put the London Metropolitan Police on a proper footing. And he set up the new force, instrumental in doing that. And it really was far more organised than heretofore.
I love a brilliant subtitle in a book, and sometimes they are almost seem too dramatic. You know, for example, you have mad dogs, jewels and dynamite, but it's not too dramatic because these were the dangers that this new police force faced. Mad dogs, for example, there was the problem of rabid dogs.
That was the most fun chapter in the book to research. And what had happened actually and how this book came about was, as I was researching other books over the years, I was finding scraps of information in the Chief Secretary Office registered papers, things I didn't really have a use for. And time again, when you look at those old index books over in the National Archives, you read about rabid dogs and there's scattered reports. I mean, imagine it, going onto the street, policemen to deal with these dogs would be dispatched from a police station. I mean, they were an unarmed force, armed only with truncheons. But in times where you know, there was maybe a rabid dog on the street, they'd go out with a gun and they'd shoot it, which is incredible. In one particular incident, there were scores of people bitten in one day. One dog on the south side of the city ran up from the Grand Canal, pursued by two policemen in an outside car, very reminiscent of the Keystone Cops. They managed to corner the animal. On the other side of the city, this same Sunday, a bulldog runs onto Mountjoy Street, people coming out of mass. The dog bites a lot of people, then it worries a goat to death. It wasn't just dogs, there were also mad cows as well. So it's a totally different time. I mean, people think that Victorian times were very quaint and familiar and so on. And I think TV shows tend to make it that way. But in some ways, it was a totally alien and unfamiliar place as well.
And what about jewels? Was that still a threat? Was that still something that was happening at the time?
Well, one of the last jewels ever fought was on Dollyman Strand. And the DMP came and they managed to break it up. But there were occasional duels. And what I discovered was that, interestingly enough, when bicycles came into vogue, there were duels from time to time fought on bicycles, where two assailants armed with swords would race at each other, cycling at full tilt, which is crazy.
And there was also the problem of the Fenians and how they responded to that.
Well, as you know, over the years, I've looked into the Fenian movement extensively. It's going to be the subject of my next book. So I had lots of material on the Fenians. One of the most poignant and tragic incidents was right in the midst of the second Home Rule movement, as the bill was being debated. Christmas Eve 1892, a constable called Patrick Sinnott was walking back up the laneway at Exchange Court, where the detective officers were, bent down to pick up this lighting package. He was an ex-school teacher. Maybe he had a little bit of natural curiosity. He wanted to find out what this is. And he was blown to smithereens, and they found one of his fingers, gruesomely enough, in the chief secretary's library. This was just adjacent, of course, to City Hall, and all the windows on Dame Street blew out, plate glass windows. And there was a woman called Madame Margaret who ran a pet shop, and she was knocked unconscious. She was dazed, and she came to the sound of her parrot saying, "Oh, Mama, whatever is the matter?"
Very good. Now, there was also some quirky things that they had to enforce, or things that would seem unusual to us. For example, they had to administer fines for all kinds of offences, and some of them were things that might seem a little absurd to us, like throwing snowballs.
That's right, and flying kites as well. But the snowballs, I mean, in one particular incident, the students of Trinity College waged this pitched battle against people from the tenements. And one hapless DMP constable who got caught up in it was dragged into the college and taken captive. I mean, you can't imagine it today. But yeah, snowball fights were illegal. And again, in the chief secretary office papers, you find accounts of this from time to time. So
we have a sense of what life was like in Victorian London from various movies, and there's the atmospheric fog and there's crime going on in the background. Was Dublin in this period something similar?
Well, you had about 60 days of fog every winter. Fog that was so thick, it was a pea soup, that mail vans tended to get lost on their way to the GPO. People would fall into the canals and drown. And the police suffered terribly because of this, because remember, they were out in all sorts of conditions. So chest complaints were particularly rife. There were a couple of hospitals known as the DMP Men's Hospital, Mercer's Hospital being one, the old Richmond Hospital on the other side of the city being another. But they'd take shelter in cabman shelters, to try and get out of the cold. But I mean, fog that was so thick that you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And remember, there were still lots of alleys and, you know, back streets, chickens and farmyard animals and, pigsties and all sorts of things that they had to negotiate and navigate in these dangerous streets. And then, I mean, you know, from the shadows, garrotters would emerge. In the 1870s, there was a scourge of garrotting, where a guy would come up behind maybe a gentleman walking on Merrion Square or somewhere, put a cord around his neck, pull it tightly, and they'd rob his money or whatever valuables he had. And to arm themselves against the garrotters, gentlemen carried sword canes. So it looked like a fairly innocuous cane, but you press a button, a little lever, and a sword comes out. Or anti-garrotting gloves. Or what they would do sometimes is wear a studded collar so that the garrotter would find himself cut and bruised by these spikes.
And Barry, before we let you go, can we talk about the experience that you've had teaching history? Because you've written very passionately in the Irish Times and elsewhere about how the study of history gives students such a range of skills that helps them with things that go beyond the study of history helps them deal with and helps them understand the modern world, that you get that sense of the importance of history.
Absolutely. I think in Ireland there's still an over-reliance in the curriculum on names and dates, facts and figures. When I went out to Australia last year, I was very interested to see that there is more of, an interest in weighing up sources, sifting, you know, bias, propaganda, the relative merits of a source. Do we think that this is accurate or inaccurate? Skills that students could use, transferable skills they could use in the workplace. And I think we've still a way to go in Ireland in that regard.
So history for the transferable skills.
Absolutely.
More history. Well, that's indeed the message from Talking History. And long may history continue. The book is called The Peeler's Notebook, Policing Victorian Dublin, Mad Dogs, Jewels and Dynamite, published in hardback by Mercier Press. It costs €14.99. The author, Barry Kenrick. And Barry, thank you so much for coming back and joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book brings together in a bilingual edition a first-hand account of Douglas Hyde's 8 months fundraising odyssey through the United States from 1905 to 1906. The book is called Douglas Hyde, My American Journey. It's published in hardback by UCD Press and costs €50. The editors are Lee McMahona, Breen O'Connor, Neil Comer, Coon O'Sheridan and Maura Nick-Onvard. And I'm delighted to welcome one of the editors, Breen O'Connor, to the show tonight. Breen, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you.
People are always interested in the life and legacy and the life and the career of Douglas Hyde and fascinated by his time as president and his presidency of the Gaelic League and so on. But they don't really know very much about this visit to the United States. Why did he go there?
He was invited by John Quinn to raise money for Conor na Gaeilge, the Gaelic League, and to reveal, to show to the Irish in America that the Gaelic League was a cultural force, a coming cultural force in Ireland in the new century. So Quinn had been to Ireland in 1902, and he attended the unveiling of a new plaque, a new headstone over the poet Raftery's grave in County Galway. And it was there, it was organized by Lady Gregory, and it was Hyde who gave the oration. And that was the first time that Quinn and Hyde had met. They met later that evening at Lady Gregory's house in Coole Park, and Quinn was very impressed with W.B. Yeats, clearly, and with Hyde. And he invited both men to come to the States. Yeats went first. Hyde was hesitant to go. He was recently married, had two young children, and his father was ill. And it was only after his father had died in 1905, while he was still mourning, he now felt the time was right for him and his wife, Lucy, to go to the States and to leave the children. The children were old enough to be cared for by nannies and nurses back in Roscommon.
And during this time when he was over there, there was that terrible, devastating earthquake in San Francisco. And that had a huge impact on their trip as well. And you see a very emotional and a very significant response to it.
Yes. San Francisco was the high point of the tour. So while Harvard, Yale, the White House were wonderful, the reception in the Midwest in Chicago was very popular and was well received. It was San Francisco was the crowning glory. This is where he was accorded all the trappings associated with a visiting head of state. And even though he wasn't yet the president of Ireland, he was being feted and treated like the president of Ireland. And there were several dinners hosted by the governor of the state. And he fell in love with San Francisco, with Berkeley. He described it as Tiernan Og. And it was he was quite lucky to escape San Francisco when he did. He was on his way to Memphis on a train, an overnight train, when he saw, passing through a train station, he saw the headline in the newspaper that San Francisco was burning. And he describes in detail how anxious he was to get information, how difficult it was in 1906, 1907 to get up to get contemporary, up to the moment information. And it takes a couple of days for him to realize that the people in whose houses he had stayed, with whom he had been to restaurants, were dead, missing. The hotel where he had given his speech and where there was the banquet in his honour was no more. And he felt so badly about this that he wrote to headquarters in Dublin straight away and looked for permission to return $5,000 to the relief fund in San Francisco. He said it was only fair that these people had put their hands in their pockets to support the Irish language and the Gaelic League, and that now, in their hour of need, the money should be returned to them.
The book has a brilliant selection of original images and handwritten postcards and so on. Do we get a sense from the diary and the journal what he thought about the United States in that period and maybe what he thought about Irish America?
Yes. The diary is very good on revealing the politics and the tensions within Irish America. So he has to be careful when dealing with newspapers and reporters not to get drawn into arguments about the United Irish League or Clonmel or Home Rule or John Redmond. But he has a very keen eye. Everywhere he goes, he describes the social status of the Irish, the religious breakdown, the percentage, the ethnic breakdown, and to what extent the Irish are integrated into the political and social network of that city, that town, or that state.
Very good. And finally then, what role did this publication, it was first published in Irish in 1937, what role did it have in his life and his presidency?
So it was initially envisioned as a history of the Gaelic League, that he was going to write this, having stepped down as president several years earlier. And then the section about America just grew and grew because he had kept a diary at the time, obviously, and that diary became this book. Now, there's a school of thought there that this 1937 publication by Ongoom, with plate, black and white plates of where he was and the people he met on his tour, was part of an unofficial election campaign to help him become president. It presents him as an Irish dignitary who is comfortable giving lectures at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Berkeley. He is comfortable with bishops, governors of states. He's been to the White House twice. So it presents an image of Hyde as president in waiting before he's actually appointed.
Okay, well, Breen, thanks a million for joining me tonight to talk about Douglas Hyde, My American Journey. The book is published in hardback by UCD Press. It costs €50. The editors are Lee McMahona, Breen O'Connachur, Neil Comer, Coon O'Sheridan, and Maura Nick Onvart. And my thanks to Breen O'Connachur for joining me tonight to talk about it. Breen, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History. On News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Because of its shared English language, as well as the celebrated origin tales of the Mayflower and the rebellion of the British colonies, the United States has prized its Anglo heritage above all others. However, a new book explores how the nation has much older Spanish roots, ones that have long been unacknowledged or marginalised. The book is called El Norte, the epic and forgotten story of Hispanic North America. It's published in hardback by Grove Press UK and costs £25 sterling, so about €28. The author is Carrie Gibson. And Carrie, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
It's a book that explores the marginalisation of the United States' Hispanic past. And I suspect it's a book that the current American president wouldn't enjoy reading.
No. But he might actually learn something if he did. El Norte tries to put what has been a long marginalised history sort of front and centre. And when I started this project, it was well before the Trump era, and as time went on, it, you know, became increasingly evident to me how important this history was and what a time to be discussing it.
And why do you think the Anglo heritage or the English-British heritage was prized above the Hispanic heritage? Why was the other marginalized?
There's a variety of reasons. One of them would be the kind of persistence of the Black legend. So the idea of the Catholicism of the Spaniards being an issue, their corruption, their bloodthirstiness, in the Americas, which of course was a similar bloodthirstiness and greed on the part of British colonists. But you know, when the first settlers to the U.S. From England were Protestant. So you know, in almost from the beginning, there was this kind of sort of religious, I guess, schism would be maybe the right word, between Catholics and Protestants. And so because Spain was a Protestant country and because it had long been a foe of England and later Britain, that sort of set the tone. In addition, Spanish were the first Europeans to set foot in what we consider to be the United States. They were exploring Florida by 1513. But they never really had the settlement numbers in quite the same way. So if you think about the Spanish Empire and you think about Mexico or Peru, where there's far more Spanish settlers, there are bigger just population centers. So when the early arrivals from England go to what becomes New England, they encounter Native Americans, but they don't really encounter any Spanish resistance. I mean, that happens later on and further south, sort of between places like South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. So in some ways, the English and later the British were able to colonize that part of North America without having to deal with the Spaniards. So that kind of feeds into it as well. It's almost as if there were sort of these two competing European nations working their way in from different directions. And because of the scale, certainly in the East, you do get that Anglo dominance. Now, the story of the West is slightly different. And this is where the Hispanic past is much more alive, in the sense that, you know, there are people whose families go back to well before the creation of the United States being on that land and being of, at some point in their past, of Spanish descendants. So yeah, there's almost again another kind of tale of two histories within that.
And you get a sense from your answer there about the geographical scope of the book, because it involves you traveling extensively the Caribbean, Florida, all around, because the story encompasses so many of those parts. It's South Carolina, it's Florida, and it's further afield.
Yes, that's right. And I had to spend quite a lot of time on the road. I put about 10,000 miles on a car, so I tried to kind of cover everything, because I grew up in the U.S., and so I knew parts of the places, but despite having grown up in the U.S. and part of my childhood in Georgia, I didn't know anything about the fact that one of the earliest settlements was, Spanish settlements, was in Georgia in 1526, so they think it was along what is now the Georgia coast, but was what was then described, you know, by the Spaniards, or claimed by the Spaniards as Florida. So I almost had to begin again and kind of drive through a lot of America drive through a lot of the United States with new eyes. And then in a similar way, I didn't want the book to just be about Mexico and the U.S. Cuba and Puerto Rico are very important parts of this story. So I wanted to make sure and include them and spend time on the islands and go to archives there and historical sites and that sort of thing as well.
And that's dealt with brilliantly in the book. But you say that you want to be more than Mexico, but Mexico does feature largely, and the border features, because it's still such a contentious issue today. And we see that it's more than lines on a map, and we see how it also has changed over those centuries.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The modern United States that we think of it, you know, as we see it, at least the continental part of it, only dates back to 1848. And after the Mexican-American War that began in 1846, the U.S. won and they were given 51% of Mexico. Now, the Rio Grande could sort of become a natural boundary, which it was set out in the treaty to be. But some of the other boundaries going westward and finding that line and sort of drawing a line in the desert in parts, was actually quite fraught. In the period just after the treaty, there were surveys that were sent out, and the surveying teams had issues with maps being wrong, with where to put boundaries, and then it was resurveyed again in the late 19th century. So the idea that there's some kind of fixed border, and also some kind of fixed, you know, difference between the United States and northern Mexico isn't really borne out by the history. And certainly when you're there and you see it, you know, having stood in places in Arizona and New Mexico, it's very hard in parts to see where, you know, where one country ends, another begins. It's not like the landscape changes dramatically in some places. So that also was really important to me, to actually go out and see the border. And of course, I saw what was then the, well, and what still is the border wall, such as it is, the security fence that's there now. But I haven't been back to see what additions have been made to it. But the idea that, yeah, one place in this landscape is different to another, you know, you can see it with your own eyes that a lot of it isn't. It is very much part of the same land and the same story.
And it's fascinating that some of the questions that dominate today, questions about race and language and citizenship, were questions that started to be asked in the 19th century.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, this acquisition of 51% of Mexico really opened a bit of a Pandora's box about these issues, because all of a sudden there were questions over what to do with people who were not black, but who were also not necessarily what political leaders in Washington and so forth would call white. It was, how do we incorporate these people, you know, with their different language, with their different customs into the nation? And one of the things I write about in the book is the statehood struggle in New Mexico, because New Mexico had a majority Spanish-speaking population after the Mexican-American War, when it became part of the U.S., and it remained a territory until 1912, in part because there were people opposed to it becoming a state in Washington, D.C. There were people in Washington, D.C. who were opposed to it becoming a state because they felt that there was still too much of a Hispanic influence. Too many people spoke Spanish. There were too many Catholics. It was corrupt. It was, so you see all of these kind of themes that, you know, that we talk about now in terms of race and citizenship and who belongs. These play out almost immediately from 1848 onwards. And certainly there were prejudices even earlier back, as I said, with the Black legend and that sort of thing as well.
Okay, well, congratulations on the book. A brilliant new study. It's called El Norte, The Epic and Forgotten Story of Hispanic North America. It's published in hardback by Grove Press UK and costs about €28. The author, Carrie Gibson. And Carrie, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book looks at the most influential Victorian building in the city of Dublin and explores the new standard which it set, looking at the geology, quarrying, building, carving and architectural design which created this spectacular structure. And it's all explored in a series of essays by established scholars and experts in the field. The book is called The Museum Building of Trinity College Dublin, A Model of Victorian Craftsmanship. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press and costs €50. The editors are Christine Casey and Patrick Wise Jackson. And I'm delighted to welcome Patrick Wise Jackson to the show tonight. Patrick, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
What's fascinating, Patrick, is that this is a building that perhaps not everyone in the country would be familiar with, but as it's described here, it is so influential in terms of so many different parts of its construction and so many aspects of its design.
That's certainly true. The reason the book came about was to draw those various facets together. And I'm a geologist. Christine Casey is an architectural historian. And we thought, here is a great opportunity to look at various areas within that and then see precisely what the architectural styles were, what the fabric of the building was, who produced both the stone in terms of its quarrying and fabrication, but also the carving of the stone. And where did that stone come from? And why did the architects choose it? Was there any reason why they wanted this material in the first place? What were they trying to do?
So let's talk about the design of the building. What were the factors that were involved there?
Well, the design was interesting. It came about after an architectural competition. The architects who were awarded the contract were Thomas Dean, Benjamin Woodward, and son Thomas Dean from Cork. But most of the design was actually carried out by Benjamin Woodward. And what they wanted to show was essentially naturalistic carvings, utilization of naturalistic stone from Ireland, and yet to show it off in really an amalgam of different styles. And while people have said, well, it's very Venetian, you can see the influence of the stones of Venice on the design. Once we start to interrogate the building and look at it in detail, small elements of it, we could see design elements from elsewhere.
And there's some wonderful chapters as well, going back before the design, going back into the quarries and the extraction and even how the marble was transported to Dublin.
Well, that was a fascinating story. I wondered, particularly being a geologist, I wondered why did they pick some of these materials and what was what was utilised beforehand. And there were examples of Connemara marble that was well known. Cork wasn't well known. Kilkenny black and Galway black was quite well known. But there was an attempt to bring on board utilisation of stone to aid development of Ireland after the famine. And I think there was a sense of, was there going to be an industrial revolution in Ireland? Well, there we don't unfortunately have too much coal, we don't have iron ore, but we do have stone. And so the designers looked at this. The Geological Survey had been set up in 1845. They were mapping the country. Some of the sources of the stone were becoming available. And of course, we had Charles Y. Williams and other people developing networks of transportation.
What did they believe they were building? Why was it necessary to go to such lengths to create such a spectacular building?
I think they believed they were building a venue that would inspire the students. And you have to remember, at the time, it was really only the students and the faculty in Trinity that would have seen this building. So they were there designing a building for the School of Engineering that also encompassed geology to really instill a wonderful place to work. The rooms were airy. It was a big building, but there were only 17 rooms within it. And so they were designed as museum spaces for sort of extracurricular learning, but also lecture spaces as well.
There is a wonderful essay on the ventilation system, and it was quite ingenious what they designed.
Well, having been a student in the building, I can appreciate why you need a good ventilation system. And although there were the rooms were very large, they designed a system at the time when people were really worried about the effects of the bad air and miasmas and so on. And drawing on work that had been done for the Houses of Parliament and research done to ensure that that was actually well ventilated, Benjamin Woodward designed a system that drew in air into the building and then was vented through inverted cones on the ceiling. So the stale air would rise and then it would get vented out the side of the building. And so it also allowed the heat to be transmitted through the building as well. It was an efficient system that unfortunately now is largely blocked up.
So how did it evolve then after completion? Because it's very interesting to look at how it's been used, but also interesting questions about conservation over the centuries as well.
That is one of the major things that comes out of this book. In one of the chapters, we looked at the original fabric of the building, the use of the rooms, and it was initially used for engineering. The School of Divinity also had space in it. There was a history library. Lecky ended up donating his library that was in that building as well. But over time, the two major museum spaces, which were enormous, absolutely enormous, 88 foot by about 35 foot and two stories high, it became clear in the 1950s that teaching wasn't done by a look and learn type approach. So the engineering museum and the geology museum were subdivided horizontally and vertically.
Now, one of the great strengths of the book is the wonderful illustrations in it, because you get an incredible sense of the way colours were used in the design. You get an incredible sense of the detail that went into the ornamentation, and it really brings the building to life. So it's something to complement the wonderful essays.
Well, I think we were very lucky, first of all, with Martin Fanning and Four Courts Press have produced a really beautiful book. And we were also very fortunate that the building on the exterior had been cleaned fairly recently, so the carvings there were pristine pretty well. But internally, it certainly needs some work. I think there's a great opportunity to clean the interior of the building and indeed look at the use of the space. All the rooms have been subdivided. Is there an opportunity to open them up again, create some of these exhibition spaces as they were, and get people coming into the building to not only have the wow factor of the central hallway, which is superb, but also the wow factor of some of the other rooms as well?
So when people come to Trinity to see the long room and the Book of Kells and areas like that, perhaps they should think about also going to see the museum building.
Absolutely. They would be more than welcome. And we will be moving a geology museum back into the building within the next year. So there's more for the visitor as well.
OK, well, it's an absolutely brilliant collection of essays by some leading scholars. It's called The Museum Building of Trinity College Dublin, A Model of Victorian Craftsmanship. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press, beautifully illustrated, and costs €50. The editors, Christine Casey and Patrick Wise-Jackson. And Patrick, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History. On News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Now, to end the show tonight, we're going to look at a new book which tells the story of University College Galway from 1930 to 1980, bringing together the reminiscences of dozens of people who were there. And interviews were conducted with everyone from college presidents to ground staff, from students who began their college lives in the 1930s to the post-free education student activists of the 1970s. The book is called An Oral History of University College Galway, 1930 to 1980, A University in Living Memory. It's published in paperback by Four Courts Press and costs €25. The author is the wonderful Jackie E. Kiona, and I'm very delighted to welcome her to the show tonight. Jackie, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Patrick. It's lovely to be here.
It's a fascinating study because you really get not just a very interesting insight into University College Galway, UCG, but also into how Ireland changed in this period, because education was really transformed.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose I knew a little bit of the background of this because I'd done the HDIP myself many years ago. So I knew a little bit about the history of education, but I didn't really expect to hear as much of the social history of education emerge from the interviews. But that's precisely what happened. And, you know, things like money being such a huge factor. I mean, we all knew, and certainly the statistics were there, that a third of the population were leaving primary school with no prospect of going on to secondary school. That was certainly the case up until free education introduced in 1967. But what I didn't realise, I suppose, and what people's interviews told me, was how the other aspects of education, or the cost of education, impacted on people. For example, people were taken out of the workforce if they went on to third level. And so from that perspective, that meant it was a huge sacrifice for families to send their children, their brightest and their best of their children, to third level, not to mind sending them to second level. So the cost of it, the amount of time they had to spend at college, paying for their digs and their accommodation, it was a huge commitment, and it was a really a fascinating exploration of that social history of education. This project, I think, did that.
And money was a factor even in terms of what you could study, because you may not be able to afford to study the number of years required for medicine, for example, unless you had that backing at home.
That's exactly right. A number of the students that I interviewed, I mean, I think when I say students, like, they were all in their 70s and 80s by the time I was interviewing them. But for many of them, when they came to university, it was a case of they had no idea what they were going to study, or else they had a sort of idea. And literally the system was that you queued up and you talk to the various deans of the different faculties and different disciplines, and you registered for the one you wanted to do. And many of them said to me that for them, the prospect of medicine was a non-starter because it was 7 years and their parents simply would not have been able, number one, to have sustained them at university for that amount of time. But secondly, things like laboratories, you know, they had to do labs if you were doing medicine, and they were all extra added on to the cost of the actual basic fee. So for many, it was a case of do the degree that's going to get you through college fast and give you a career that you could actually start earning straight away at the other end of it. And teaching was one of those professions.
what's fascinating is that it was actually a Galway graduate, the Minister for Education, Donogh O'Malley, who brought in free education then in the 1960s.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. He was an extraordinary character. And I was so fortunate. I mean, I met or I interviewed two people who'd actually been at college with him, who knew him very well, one of whom had his girlfriend stolen by Donogh O'Malley, which is a great story in the book. But they all had a sense of O'Malley, that he was this real go-getter. He was a star even at university. He was somebody who everybody knew and everybody looked up to. But his initiative, I think, in introducing free education was an absolute game changer for third level. And he said something in his speech when he introduced it in 1966, and it was a bolt from the blue. Nobody was expecting it. But he said in his speech, education is the one great leveler upper. And I thought that was a great line. And it was very much symptomatic or typical of the man that he would have seen it in that light. But what he did was introduce people who had never had a prospect of going to second level and therefore not progressing to third level before. And so in the 1970s, you start seeing an influx of these very bright young men and women from working class backgrounds who utterly transformed the social aspect of education, but also were bringing a whole new level of ability and a cross-class understanding of society that had not been there before when they came out as graduates.
Our much-loved president, Michael D. Higgins, was both a student at the university and then also a lecturer. Does he pop up often in the recollections and the memories of people?
Absolutely. Everybody loved Michael D. There were some terrific stories about him because he was a star even then. You know, he was full of vim and vigor and full of he was one of those young people who were coming, I suppose, from having really had to excel in order to get scholarships and get to university. And he very much appreciated that. But he was also somebody who was very charismatic, even at that stage. And people who were fellow students of his knew that this sense of social justice was there from the very beginning. Any cause, he was there fighting it. But then when he returned as a lecturer in Sauk and Paul, he became one of the favourite lecturers of students because he was much younger than a lot of the other lecturers. So he was very much on a par with his fellow students, or the students he was teaching, rather. But he was also just one of these, he's absolutely, you know, he was a whirlwind. Somebody described him to me in that sense, that he had, I think at the time, he had a Fiat Bambino car, and he used to drive recklessly around university in this Fiat Bambino. But everybody adored him and very much respected as a lecturer as well as a student.
What's interesting is that you get a real sense that UCG knew how to play to its strengths. It did so when it came to the Irish language and its connections there. Also in terms of its unique local advantages in terms of the sea and the environment. And this gave it a distinctiveness and also maybe a competitive edge.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I mean, that's the thing that did strike me. It was very, very small. I mean, when you think 1940, there was about just less than 700 students then. By 1970, it was just below 3,000. So not a huge increase in that amount of time. But they knew that they were the smallest of the universities. They knew that they were therefore on the back foot in many respects. And they did, as you say, decide to play to their strengths. The very fact that they were located in the heart of the biggest Gaeltacht in the country then was a massive plus. So one thing that did really impact on the university and its success was the Aiken scholarships of the 1940s, introduced first in 1947. And that brought the brightest and the best to UCG as it was then, because the Aiken scholarship were only tenable through the medium of Irish, if you did your studies through the medium of Irish. And it was based on the Leaving Cert results, and you had to be in the top 5% to basically be eligible for an Aiken. So that really raised the bar, and they played to their strengths. They got some fantastic people, many of whom came back to teach as professors there. But also, as you say, the fact that they were in a marine environment, the Martin Ryan Institute for the Marine Meteorological Research, those were the things that they had. They had a pristine environment on the west coast of Ireland with the riches of the sea there and the riches of all this vast marine science that they could exploit. And they did so very effectively by playing the hand that they'd been given and playing it very well.
And finally, Jackie, I think what this book shows and what the broader project shows is just the value of oral history, because without it, you would have lost so many of these pieces of evidence and pieces of our past.
Well, I mean, that I was astonished by what I discovered. I mean, there was jaw-dropping moments in the middle of some of the interviews when people just came out with these statements, and I thought, well, I didn't know about that. And just to give you one example, Patrick, one thing that did come out in the course of the interviews, which I'd never known about before, was that after the Second World War in 1946, the GI Bill of Rights was introduced in the United States. And as a result of that, a number of GIs, former GIs or demobbed GIs, came to Galway to study medicine at UCG. And that continued for many, many years. And those guys came and were they really turned heads and were really showstoppers in Galway in this post-war, which is a pretty bleak period. I had no idea that the volume of GIs had come here to study in Galway. It was quite extraordinary. And also, the other people who came were the Poles, Polish students who are, you know, from ex-RAF pilots. They came to study medicine as well. And had we not done this oral history project, we would not have heard about them and captured the reminiscences of people who knew them personally and could tell their story. It was a real privilege to being able to access those stories.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, it's the June Bank holiday weekend, and we'll be playing you one of my favourite shows of the year, Dr. Livingston, I presume, as we find out how an explorer and missionary became an international icon in the 19th century. And then in 2 weeks' time, we'll be looking at the life and music of the great composer Dvorak. So join us next week and the week after on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.